Hello, everyone. I'm Tammy Johnson. I'm the Director of Strategic Partnerships for the Applied Research Center. Welcome, all of you, to the Compact for Racial Justice Forum call on race and the economy. This is really exciting. We have over 300 people who are RSVP to this call, so there's going to be quite a few of us joining this phone line. Before we delve in, I want to give a few housekeeping notes. Throughout the call, you hear these lovely beats. Those are people coming in. And I'm going to spend some time talking to give some folks some time to join us this afternoon. I also want to inform everyone that this call is being recorded for ARC's use and for the use of other media outlets. And ARC will be posting a recording of this call on our website that you can go and revisit and share with your colleagues. We're also asking participants to direct their questions to us after the presentations via email. Send your name, your organizational affiliation, if applicable, and your question to compact@arc.org. That's C-O-M-P-A-C-T, all one word, at arc.org, compact.org. For those of you who are unfamiliar with ARC, the Applied Research Center is a racial justice think tank that bridges policy research, media advocacy, and community activism together. ARC is hosting this series of compact forum calls because we feel that it's important to create a space to share ideas about how to apply a racial equity framework in this flurry of policy proposals that are coming out of the Beltway in D.C., in state capitals, proposals that will have a major implications on people of color and how their living standards, and implications for racial equity as a whole. So that's why the Applied Research Center has created the Compact for Racial Justice. The Compact promotes a policy agenda for unity and fairness, one where equity and inclusion are paramount in both the content of policy proposals and the policy-making process. Now, I want to encourage all of you to check out the Compact page at arc.org and support the and sign the Pledge for Racial Justice there. More about that later. So here we are, 14 days into the Obama administration. In this discussion about race and the economy, we want to focus on how we can advance a viable policy alternatives that would truly benefit everyone. Why is that important? Because the economic recession is having a disproportionate adverse impact on communities of color. For example, a report by United for Fair Economy estimates that people of color lost between $164 and $213 billion, that's what it'd be, from the subprime lending crisis. With the greatest wealth loss, that's the greatest wealth loss for people of color in modern U.S. history. Unemployment levels in communities of color is increasing at the same time that needed social services are being cut by states across the country. All of this is occurring while the U.S. is now just a generation away from having a population that is a majority of people of color. And despite those changing demographics, the nation's wealth continues to be concentrated in a small population of white individuals. So it is in this context that we're having this conversation and asking ourselves, how do we begin to apply standards for racial equity to these new policies? How do we make them stick? How do we ensure that there's accountability from our government and from others? To discuss this topic today, we have a great panel of speakers. First, and I'm going to introduce them in the order that they will be speaking. First will be Andrea Batista Schlesinger, who is the Executive Director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy. She will be presenting her analysis of the federal stimulus package and its potential impact on communities of color. She will be followed by Terry Kelleher, ARC's Director of the Racial Justice Leadership Action Network, who will speak about the importance of advancing a racial impact assessment in this period of time. And we'll conclude with some on-the-ground examples of how this is done with Beth Newkirk, who is the Executive Director of the Organizing Apprenticeship Project of Minnesota. Beth will speak about applying these racial equity standards through their kitchen table budget principles. So let's begin. And
great. Can you hear me?
Just a little bit louder, perhaps.
Okay. Thanks for having me here on this call. And I've got with me Harry Morose, who's on the phone as well. And he is responsible for monitoring happening in Congress for our site, themiddleclass.org, bills. And so I'm going to do a little bit an overview, and then Harry will either jump in with the specifics or get to that in the questions. So, what I overall wanted to say, and Tammy, what do I have, like 7 minutes? Is that what?
About eight.
8 minutes, okay. I got an extra minute in there. Excellent. So what I wanted to do was just first say big picture that, when it comes to the way we are thinking about this stimulus package and its impact on our communities, we've got a possibly good, and a good. And that is roughly divided into thirds. The bad is the third of stimulus that is directed towards tax cuts. The tax cuts that are included in the package, and again, Harry can get into some of these specifics, are for the most part not going to help our communities and our and as you, I'm sure, as everyone has seen and followed in the coverage of this, the effort at some kind of post-partisanship.
And
the third that that could be good, but we don't know, is the third that will be spent on infrastructure. And we can talk a little bit about that, but it's essentially spending on public buildings.
Tammy Johnson.
The $275 billion in tax cuts, and now I'm looking at the House bill. Some of the tax cuts that are very targeted will be helpful to our communities, but for the most part, in general, they are not viewed as effective stimulus, and they certainly kind of a holdover from the supply-side economics of our friends on the right and are not viewed to be directly of benefit, to our communities. And I can certainly go through, and Harry can go through, each of these tax cuts. I mean, again, there are some that are quite helpful. Increasing the earned income tax credit in 2009 and 2010 for households with three or more children, and increasing the income at which the credit is phased out for all households. The child tax credit, any household will receive 15% of their earned income in 2009 and 2010 for the refundable portion of the child tax credit. Making work pay tax credit, that's a refundable tax credit in 2009 and 2010 for working people, phases out at $75,000. That was the subject of some controversy since the GOP didn't want a refundable tax credit. They wanted it only to people who pay income taxes, and that was the and, of course, we have people who are too poor to pay income taxes but who should benefit from this credit, and that was the point at which President Obama told Republican congressmen, well, I won, so we're just going to have to go with my opinion on the subject. Business tax cuts, a home buyer's tax credit, those are not credits that are either going to be effective stimulus or that will directly benefit our communities. And the second chunk of money is the one that there are a lot of questions about, so infrastructure. It's about a third of the House bill. Public buildings, highways, transit, school modernization. The House has about $30 billion in for highway projects. It's unclear if it's new construction or if it's repair. Clearly, people that care about increasing transit and not building, facilitating more sprawl, would like it to be repair as opposed to new construction. $12 billion for transit and rail, and the hope is that in the Senate bill it will be more. And then, of course, funds to weatherize homes and increase energy efficiency in federal buildings. There's a question mark there because those jobs or the jobs in that industry aren't necessarily going to directly benefit our community. So it's a question. It's not a yes or a no. It's a question. There are some reporting requirements for contracts for minority-owned businesses, but there are no explicit requirements. There are no explicit requirements on the quality of the job, there are no explicit requirements on the hiring of low-income people for those jobs. So there's a question there. And then in the third chunk of money, which is to go primarily to the states, that's the money that we're going to have to fight at state levels to be directed to the policies that we know will help our communities. I mean, we know that unemployment can reach as high as 18.2% according to EPI for African Americans, 13.1% for Hispanics, significantly higher than the 9% for whites. And so reforming unemployment insurance, extending it, increasing it, there's currently $40 billion in the House plan for that, is important. The regular 26 weeks of unemployment insurance would be extended an additional 33 weeks. That matters. We need to push for unemployment insurance modernization, and there's about $7 billion in incentives for that, so including part-time workers, including low-wage workers. And Harry can talk about some of the ways in which, those or reasons that those workers are often left out of unemployment insurance, but that's something that is provided for in at least the House side of the stimulus package, but something that we need to fight for in particular for communities of color to benefit from the stimulus package. The health insurance plans to increase the federal state Medicaid matching rate are very important, of subsidizing COBRA so that people won't lose their health insurance is key. And then, of course, funding to states to specifically offset cuts in education. So about $80 billion to prevent cuts in state education services. And then more specifically and very helpfully, Pell Grants will increase another $500. There's money for school modernization and repairs, child care, Head Start, and $13 billion in Title I funds. And then, there are a series of funds to increase or allocations to increase food stamp benefits, community development block grant funding to purchase and rehabilitate vacant foreclosed properties so you can create more affordable housing. This is in addition to funds that were appropriated for the same purpose by an act that passed in July, the American Housing Rescue and Foreclosure Prevention Act, and you can read more about that in addition to the stimulus bill on our site, themiddleclass.org. There's money for homeless assistance grants to state and local governments, to expand broadband in underserved areas, although it's not quite clear yet which underserved areas they mean. $1 billion for low-income home energy assistance, $20 billion for health information technology, which I think is another question mark in terms of whether we are privatizing information ahead of a reform in the system in total, but it's another way, of course, to put people to work and to get us closer on the path of looking at healthcare. So, in terms of now I've definitely gone over my 8 minutes, and so I'm glad to answer questions, and Harry is glad to answer questions about it. I think ultimately what we need to keep in mind is that this bill, and certainly the Senate bill, will be more so a series of compromises, and what we need to keep our eye on is how much is spent on tax cuts that will be ineffective for our communities, how much will go towards infrastructure, which may or may not directly help our communities, and third, how we ensure that state governments spend money in the ways that are intended directly to relate to issues of unemployment extension and modernization, to deal with health insurance, to prevent cuts to health care, to deal with vacant and foreclosed properties, to beef up food stamp programs, and that's where I think our local efforts need to be most concentrated on.
Andrea, you're a trooper. Thank you so much. This is Tammy. That was me interrupting you that last time.
Oh, okay.
I think we have our roll call glitch addressed. So sorry, everyone. I just want to update folks who may have just joined us that the Q&A today, we're asking people to email us your questions with your name, your organizational affiliation, to compact@arc.org. compact@arc.org. And next is Terry Kelleher with ARC's Director of the Racial Justice Leadership Action Network.
Thanks, Tammy. I'm going to talk about racial equity impact assessments and how they can be applied to economic policies and public budgets. So I'll briefly discuss what they are, why they're needed, how you can use this kind of analysis, and then I'll provide some examples and some additional resources. Though the stimulus packet is a very immediate application, I want to broaden my remarks to apply to any kinds of economic and budgetary decisions, whether federal, state, or local, since many of us will be working on these issues at a lot of different levels. So to begin with, what it is, a racial equity impact assessment is a conscious and careful analysis of the effects of public decisions on different racial and ethnic groups. Conducting a racial equity impact assessment is a useful way to assess the actual or the anticipated effects of public policies and budgets. It's a tool to identify ways to maximize equity and inclusion and to minimize adverse, unanticipated impacts. And this kind of analysis can be done by anyone, including research and policy groups, community organizing and advocacy organizations, writers and journalists, or even policy-making bodies. And there's simple and informal ways to do it, and there's more elaborate and formal ways to do it. So I'm going to try and go through just sort of some of the simple steps involved. But first, why should we even do these? So a big reason is the economic crisis we're in. It has high-stakes effects on a lot of people, but especially people of color who are experiencing disproportionate adverse impacts. So racial equity impact statements can be a critical tool at a critical time for seriously addressing the structural inequalities that lie at the root of many of the problems we're currently facing. Secondly, the racial equity impact statements are designed to give conscious attention to racial inequality. Because systemic racial inequality is produced routinely, often unintentionally and invisibly, it's important to make these dynamics explicit and transparent. There's a wide body of new and emerging research on implicit racial bias, which demonstrates that individuals and institutions replicate racial inequality when we're not consciously counteracting it. And especially in a time when concepts such as post-racialism and colorblindness are gaining in popularity, it's even more important that we make existing patterns of racial inequality more explicit and transparent. A third reason for using racial equity impact assessments is they can be a proactive and preventative tool for addressing racial inequality. They can be used to affirmatively promote equity and inclusion and to consciously prevent adverse impacts and unanticipated consequences. Racism can't be solved if we're only reactive and only focused on raising grievances. We need to offer proactive solutions. We need to prevent further racial inequalities through our institutional policies, practice, spending priorities. And a last reason where I think this can be a valuable tool is that they can help us think more consciously about public participation. They can help us give more serious consideration to who the direct stakeholders are, who is most adversely impacted, and who needs to be at the table when proposed policies are being developed and considered. So now I'll move into how you do them. What I want to do is refer you, if you have access, to our racewire.org. And we have posted there a downloadable description and tool that people can use. And if you go to racewire.org, RACEWIRE.org, at that site you will find a link or a downloadable tool that you can open. And on the second page you'll see of that tool, you'll see a guide that offers a set of questions for consideration when you're looking at different policies to assess. They walk you through how to analyze some of the current problems, how to develop possible proposals, and how to review the different proposals. And the idea being to figure out ways to maximize opportunities to advance equity and to advance inclusion, to reduce inequalities or hopefully eliminate them, and to take what other opportunities there may be to anticipate what the impacts might be, so that you can prevent the adverse impacts. A lot of bills and policies, notoriously, are like our drug policies. If they had gone through a more serious and systematic review on the front end to consider racial impacts, we wouldn't be seeing the adverse effects of so many people of color incarcerated because of nonviolent drug offenses. That's probably the most glaring example of a policy that you know, really could benefit by this kind of tool. A few tips when you're doing this kind of analysis is that I know that economic policies, budgets, they can be very complex. Don't feel like you have to tackle the whole thing and analyze them in their entirety. You can pick particular issue areas where you want to focus, perhaps education or healthcare or whatever your interest may be, and just look at that and try and do your best to assess what the impacts might be in that issue area. Also, it's helpful to consider the interests of many different racial groups. So even though you may be a Latino organization or you may be a Black organization predominantly, when you do the analysis, it's often helpful to look at how different racialized communities are affected, because that opens up possibilities for perhaps linking your interests together, and also to not pit each other, you know, against each other when you're, especially when you're looking at, you know, possibly limited dollars in a budget. You want to try and figure out the linkages rather than, you know, where we might end up being in competition with each other. Also, it's helpful to look at not just expenditure items, but also to look at revenue streams, since there can be significant inequities and opportunities by looking at both. And then the more, again, you can engage people of different racial and ethnic groups in the process of actually conducting the racial impact analysis, I think the better, because you're going to get some valuable perspectives and inputs that you might not otherwise have. So those are just, you know, very quickly some basics, but you can use the tool to give you some further information. I want to just present also a few examples of how you can think about using a racial impact analysis. And again, I'll refer you to RaceWire. Just below the posting of the toolkit is another posting that's titled Assessing Racial Equity Impacts in the House Stimulus Bill. In there, our research director, Dominic Apollon, had plotted some of the different ways that states are going to be affected by some of the jobs training funding allocation that was in the House bill. And this has two axes. One, the red line plots the actual percentage of people of color in different states, or actually the national percentage of people of color, and then different states are plotted relative to that. And then the other axis is the national per capita spending. And if you look at that, you can look at which states are you know, expected to receive more money, and you can look at you know, how they might be impacted by the money. The states to the right of the vertical line, if you're looking at this, they have a higher percentage of people of color than the national average. The horizontal green, again, is the national per capita spending on jobs. And what you'll see is states that have a lot of people of color, like Mississippi, South Carolina, California, District of Columbia, in the top right corner of the chart, are receiving a comparatively larger share of jobs training funds, while people of color in states like Hawaii, New Mexico, Texas, Maryland, they may deserve additional funds. So it might give you some basis to kind of push your own states to try and advocate for access more of the money. And even within the states, you might be in a state that looks like they might be, you know, getting more money, like Michigan or Alaska, but there's still work to be done to make sure that money gets allocated in an equitable way to make sure that communities of color are benefiting from that money. So it's just an example of where you can take a race-conscious approach to, you know, examining the actual money flow and see if there's ways to advocate for more equity with that in mind. I also want to point out lower on the RaceWire site, another posting is some work that the Center for Community Change is doing. They have a whole website set up to for people who want to actually take action on the economic stimulus package. And I know a lot of different groups are doing this, but I think that this is a pretty easy way where you can just go onto their website, push the take action button, and, you know, get linked to your senators. Right now it's particularly important to be talking to Republican senators, because the vote could be coming on the Senate floor at any time, and a lot of the opposition right now would be coming from them at this point. I think that there's in the toolkit you'll see that there's a number of other groups that are doing some really good work on this. Some groups have put up different principles and put up other policy examples. So in the toolkit, there's a listing of about a dozen groups that are doing different work, so you can find more examples and models of how they're doing that. One group that I want to point out that we're going to hear from next is the Organizing Apprenticeship Project that has done an analysis of their state budget last year. And because the next phase of all this federal stimulus money is going to be sending that money to the states, supposedly for shovel-ready projects and things like that, I think we're going to have to get out of the box pretty quickly in analyzing and advocating for ways that that money is going to be used in a real racially equitable manner. So I think Organizing Apprenticeship Project already has a model that they've done last year, and I think it's a model that can be transferred easily to other groups that want to have some say on how the new monies coming to your states are going to be used. So I want to turn it over next to Beth Newkirk, who's the executive director of the Organizing Apprenticeship Project, and want her to say a little about the report that they did called Race and Budget Matters last year. Go ahead, Beth.
Terry, am I on?
Yep,
hello?
You're on.
Okay, sorry. Well, I guess what I wanted to talk to, if it's okay, is two different things that we're doing. One was the Race and Budget Matters, which is a report that we issued, it was actually 2007, and then we're also doing something this year, which is meant to be a little bit more proactive and take a little bit deeper with our state legislative budget making. These are all part of a bigger package that are tied to, we do a racial equity report card similar to the ARC report card. We started that in 2006, and then we followed that in 2007 by an examination of the governor's proposal. And we looked at two areas, education and health, as Terry was suggesting. And we just took some key proposals in his budget and just basically used the kind of tool that Terry was outlining and just did an equity impact assessment of that. I mean, one of the examples of what would come out of that would be that the governor had a proposal to redo the school funding formula that would have put way more money in white schools and way less money in the community of color schools. And that was being touted as a very creative reform, and nobody was talking about the race equity impact. So by putting it in this thing, it actually jazzed the legislature a lot. They weren't willing to talk about race until we put it forward, and then we were able to kind of leverage that forward to kind of getting a whole lot of legislators to step forward and kind of take more interest and begin to actually, we did a training for them called Leave No Legislator Behind that was meant to kind of get legislators to look much more clearly at race equity impact of both policy and money decisions. There was a lot of pop that came out of that. I mean, everything kind of built. It's hard to take it all by itself. It built on the report card, which then went back into the budget, that went back into policy. It's tied into some organizing that groups are doing. We eventually got a lot of media attention, I think to some degree, because some of the better journalists were concerned about what was happening with budgets, and they knew that there was this impact on poor people and people of color. And they saw both race in the budget and the report card as something that gave them a way to talk about this that they hadn't had before. We had a really marvelous editorial last year looking at the report card and the race equity impact of the state legislators' policies, and it was an amazing turnaround of our press in terms of even being able to talk about racial equity. This year, I wanted to throw this in very quickly, I have 4 minutes, but this year when we moved into, we're preparing our third report card on the state, but we also knew that here, I mean, as everywhere, budget cuts is going to be huge. It was really obvious, you know, 6 months ago. And people are dividing about it, and we wanted to put the race equity impact forward, and we also wanted to kind of create an alternative frame to what the governor was doing. We have a bad governor. What we did is we went out and we put a little facility, we did what we call kitchen, we developed some kitchen table budget principles. We actually went out to communities through community organizations, mostly communities of color, you know, asked the question, you know, in tough times, how do you make budget decisions? What are the values? What are the principles you want to tell the legislature? Built that into something we call the kitchen table budget principles. And then we're starting a two-pronged kind of rollout of that. We started by rolling it out last week, got some good press, and made it concurrent with the budget's release. And the frame that's being put forward puts race equity in the center, and it's very, very different than what the government is putting, governor is putting forward. Where we're taking it, and this isn't done yet, and it'll be done in about a month, and it's Jermaine Toney here who works on that. We've had conversations with legislative friends, and we're going to be building a race equity and impact tool around budget cuts. And we have some key people on the budget committees who are willing to take it out to some budget chairs. And it's going to be 5 to 10 questions that we're going to try to get the chairs to ask about any major budget cut in the state budget. And there's a revenue side of this as well. And then we're also getting that out to organizing groups who are really liking it because people have been feeling paralyzed and as if they can only fight against each other for different items. And so this is helping people figure out some questions and some frames to organize around without just bashing into each other. So we're kind of midway through that process. So far, so good. But it's pretty exciting. It's getting a lot of attention. So I guess that's the major thing. For us, it's been a back and forth in terms of policy money, and we're kind of learning our way into how to ask the questions about money and not being afraid to ask them, even if we're not necessarily money experts. So, there, that's it. Okay? Terry, is that what you needed?
Perfect.
Okay, all right, sorry.
We'll go back to Tammy, and Tammy can field the
okay.
questions. Are you there, Tammy? I'm not hearing Tammy right now, but I know there's a mechanism for emailing in questions. So I invite people to do that. If everyone would just hold on, thank you for your patience. I'm not sure if we've got Tammy connected, but if you want to... Oh, can we hear you now, Tammy?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. All right, I'm sorry, folks. Again, more technical difficulties. People should email in their questions to contact@arc.org. And the first question I have for the panel to talk about while we're looking at a couple coming in right now is, you know, we've been through this process before, whether it's under No Child Left Behind or most recently with the Gulf Coast tragedy, where there's federal money's coming down from on high, right? And, of course, they have strings attached and they're block granted. And there are lessons that we've learned from that process, be it from welfare reform or public housing fights, where the federal money is coming. It may not be sent in the way that we want it, but it's then up to us at the state level to do our work to ensure that that money gets to our communities. All three of the panelists, I'd like to respond. What are some lessons learned in terms of those fights that we could apply to the stimulus package?
I just wanted to note, I think Andrea had to step off of the call.
Okay.
So I can step in for her. Maybe I can speak best to what's going on right now and what's important to have happen in the next couple of days. So the Senate is actually debating right now amendments to the stimulus package, which is more or less similar to the package that the House passed last week. But I would just point out a couple of differences that I think everybody should be conscious of, and there certainly is still time to contact their representatives and senators. One significant difference is that the Senate legislation does not include the rather strong provisions of health insurance through COBRA, and an additional provision that provides Medicaid to unemployed and low-income individuals after they have lost their jobs. That's not included in the Senate bill. The Senate bill includes a little bit less money for CDBG, the Community Development Block Grant programs for housing rehabilitation. And at least for right now, about $3 or $4 billion less in transit funding. So at least in the very near term, where I can respond to, those are some important things to keep in mind in the next week or so as the Senate passes this legislation, and then it goes on into conference where there'll still be lots of lobbying going on.
Anyone else?
Hello, this is Beth. I guess, one, I'm really appreciating all the information about the stimulus package. I think in terms of the state-level impact, I guess one lesson that we've learned, I think, is that it's important to kind of get in there and engage around what the framing is around budget decisions. I mean, I don't know how it is in other states, but it's very... there's this tendency here to just get in and kind of, oh no, we're the victims of budget cuts, or the victims of tax cuts, and there's kind of a dialogue that goes that where racial equity actually gets lost. And what we're really playing around with is really holding the measure of equity as important as a state value, and then just holding their feet to the fire on that over and over again, rather than just kind of playing the special interest game that they keep trying to put us into. So I guess that's a lesson. It feels like when we succeed at that, we win. When we pull people together, we win. But it's tricky not to get divided.
Okay. Our next question is from Stephen Titch with the Center for Labor Research and Education out of UC Berkeley. Any thoughts from the panelists about wages of jobs being created? What steps groups on the ground can take to ensure that these are good quality jobs?
I would just say I think it's important to try and be as proactive as possible by just feeling free to establish your own standards for what you think a good job is, which communities should be given priority attention to the hires, things like that. So I don't think you just have to wait and react. I think you can also get out of the box, know that this money is coming. Some of it's going to be going to, you know, jobs, to transportation, to schools. So feel free to, you know, set the frame, set the standards, set the priorities yourselves, and to try and get out there first out of the box on some of that, because the more they have to react to your proposals, the better.
Any other reaction to that?
I just wanted to agree with that. This is Beth. And also just the faster we get out of the box and put some stuff out, I think that the questions about who gets the jobs and what kind of jobs are actually not being asked. And I think that just asking them will change the dialogue rather quickly.
Okay, our next question is from Lisa Jenkins with Strategic Planning. There's been a talk of adding $4.1 billion to the stimulus fund for direct disbursement to nonprofits. Wondering if this made the Senate bill, and if so, what mechanisms can be used to access it, and how should it be used?
This is Harry. I actually plead ignorance to that. I'm not familiar with those with that funding. I don't know if somebody else knows about it. I will note. I mean, there are a couple of disbursement measures directly to nonprofit groups that I know are already included in the Senate bill. But I apologize. I don't know exactly what the questioner is referring to.
I think some lessons learned from some of those similar provisions. I haven't looked at this particular one, so I'm talking a little bit out of ignorance. But, you know, similar things have been put in No Child Left Behind and Wayfair, and either of those could be ties that bind organizations from being true advocates, or you can really use those to further benefit your community, and I think people need to look really sharply at that because we want to make sure that we are free to advocate for our communities, especially when it comes to questions of equity. We have a question from Kathleen Wills out of Washington, D.C. When folks in D.C. speak of affordable housing, it's almost always in the context of single-family dwellings and home ownership. Are there any provisions to stimulate the building or provision of multifamily dwellings or apartments? And what are funding of the establishment of housing development trust funds and provisions for employment of minority contractors or minority laborers? Do we have any information on that regarding housing? It definitely seems to me like a question you want to ask around issues around equity and access, right, Terry?
Yeah. And again, I think it's the similar principle. I think the more we can just, you know, look at programs that are going to really, you know, benefit those in need, that are really going to address some of the systemic and structural causes, I think we want to just, you know, do as much as we can to promote and prioritize those kind of programs and to make sure that the voices are being heard of the communities that are often, you know, not involved in some of the debates or not involved in, you know, the budgetary allocations. So, you know, the more, you know, we can step up our organizing and advocacy efforts to make sure that, you know, we're advocating for the right kind of programs, the better.
And I would add the you know, looking through this bill, it's striking how we still our obsession with single-family dwellings and particularly home ownership persists even now. I would say there are additional funds for the community development block grant, and that that goes to community organizations to purchase and rehabilitate vacant foreclosed properties. I know there were some problems with the initial allocations not going to the communities that needed them most, but there is an additional appropriation, so money has been put towards trying to rehabilitate these vacant foreclosed properties. And I would note that there are provisions to require housing that is built in place of those foreclosed properties to be affordable.
Yeah, please send more questions to compact@arc.org. I have one here from Jesse Herrera from the Monterey County Health Department and Behavioral Health Division out of Salinas, California. Is there a data collection protocol or instrument that you can use to capture and organize the response with links to budget planning? Is it adaptable to different locales?
Yeah, I'll take that one. You know, we're still in this country, we're on the sort of the early end of using racial equity impact assessments. Actually, the United Kingdom is well ahead of us in this regard. They've actually been using what they call a racial equality impact assessment for many years, and they do it in a proactive way. They've actually authorized a lot of different branches of government, right down to the public library and the police department, to come up with these racial equity schemes where they actually proactively plan how they're going to eliminate disparities, how they're going to expand equity and inclusion, and how they're going to even enhance more inter-ethnic unity and relations. So with those three goals, they have all different branches of government developing these racial equity impact assessments. And they actually, if you Google racial equality impact assessment, you'll see some of these, you'll see some of the actual plans that different agencies have developed. So that's one model that's being used. Another model, there's I think both the King County, where Seattle is located in Washington, as well as the City of Seattle, both have some proactive racial and social justice initiatives going on, where they're actually reviewing and planning in a very conscious way different ways to incorporate racial equity in the way they do government. And there's other initiatives afoot. I know there's a collection of organizations in St. Paul, Minnesota, that are working with the city council to adopt racial equity impact statements as part of the planning process there. So in answer to your question, there are many different models emerging. Some, I think the folks in Washington have a toolkit that they're using. I know the United Kingdom has some stuff. They actually have a template of questions you can access. We're going to actually put some of that up on our website. So if you stay tuned to the Compact for Racial Justice part of the website at Applied Research Center, you're going to see some updates on this, because I think this is a great moment to really advance this whole concept of racial equity. I think, you know, there's a lot of legal remedies that have not produced the kind of solutions or changes that we all had hoped, and I think that we've got to come up with more proactive and preventative ways to address racism. So I think that the racial impact statements are it's a timely time, you know, to really move those. So we're going to try and promote those and you know, present a lot more resources on our website as we go forward.
Okay, one last question coming from Ahmad Rivera with the Racial Wealth Divide of United for Fair Economy. Are there any thoughts on the absence of legislation to regulate, protect, and repair the loss of wealth to communities of color due to the foreclosure crisis? Any thoughts? Well, I think personally that this really shows what happens when you don't have some proactive thinking about race when you're crafting policy. Things such as blatant as this gets left out when race is not on the table and in a very explicit way. so you don't put together remedies to the loss of great wealth in Latino and African American community due to the foreclosure crisis. Instead, what's on the table for debate are things like tax proposals, tax cuts, which really will not serve our community well, as Andrea said up front. Are there any other responses to that?
This is a very small response, but I think there was a proposal. I'm not going to be very specific about it because I don't remember it, but there was a specific proposal last year in our legislature that was about remedying as versus just protecting. And I think we included some mention of that in the report card. It didn't pass, but it was a way to kind of raise the kind of the proactive issue and kind of shift this discussion that was kind of blaming communities of color for the financial crisis. So, I mean, it's small, but I think someone put something forward. It didn't have much of a chance, but we tried to highlight it at least.
Well, I promised people that we would try to keep them for no more than an hour. So in this last few minutes, I want you to encourage all of you to do something immediately following this call. I want to invite all of you to join organizations like the Schott Foundation for Public Education, Policy Link, the Center for Third World Organizing, and the AFL-CIO in endorsing the Compact for Racial Justice. The Compact is this agenda for fairness and unity, where we're trying to transcend the talk of personal prejudice and compel evidence of institutional racism and present realistic, proactive solutions to problems like the foreclosure crisis in our communities. Individuals can pledge for the Racial Justice Compact. You can go to our website at arc.org/compact, and there's links to a lot of the information that we mentioned here today, but also which allow you to pledge and your organization to endorse the compact. There are also links on racewire.org to the Center for Community Change action piece around the stimulus package, to the information that Terry was mentioning today. There is a toolkit there at RaceWire that you can download and use and circulate amongst your allies. And we will continue on the Compact page at arc.org to update it with more information about what people can do to really effectively engage in this information, much like the way that the Organizing Apprenticeship Project has done at the state level with the budget at the kitchen table budget principles. So I really want to thank everyone for the great patience with all of the technical glitches today. This was really wonderful that many of you stuck with us this long. I do feel like it was worthwhile conversation, and I hope to hear from all of you again in 2 weeks on February 17th, where we have a discussion specifically on race and jobs, where we will be joined by folks from the AFL talking about the Employee Free Choice Act and Green for All regarding green jobs and how we're going to ensure that there's equity in these and other policies that are put forth in this time. Thank you so much.